This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
During the pandemic, more than ever, healthcare workers must be protected, must be respected. Hospitals and healthcare facilities, including the transportation of ambulances, should not be used for military purposes.
That's Altaf Moussani, World Health Organization's Director of Health Emergencies Interventions, on the high number of health worker deaths over the last 2 years. Details coming up. Also, South Sudan's Vice President Riek Machar has been ousted as head of his party and its armed forces. These stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. The head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, said the situation in Ethiopia's Tigray region is worsening by the day, with more than 5 million people needing help after Ethiopian and allied forces pursuing Tigray fighters were accused of looting and destroying food supplies. Tigray remains cut off from the outside world, with communication links down and just one road available for aid convoys, which have faced numerous checkpoints and searches. While the West is said to be exploring the possibility of a humanitarian aid corridor from neighboring Sudan into western Tigray, the head of Ethiopia's National Disaster Risk Management Commission this week rejected that idea. During her visit, Power expressed concern about the dehumanizing rhetoric used by Ethiopia's leaders amid the nine-month-old conflict in the Tigray region. Analysts say Ms. Power's tough language is unlikely to change the minds of those involved in the conflict. For more, VOA's Chinedu Ofor spoke with Aliyai Verji, senior advisor of the Africa Center of U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington.
From the point of view of attention from the United States, it's a positive thing that she went to Ethiopia. But from our practical outcomes, it's much harder to discern. The one positive thing that happened yesterday was that the World Food Program announced that the first convoy in some time had managed to reach Tigray. But at the same time, we also saw NGOs being thrown out of Tigray. So difficult to see that there was any substantial movement from her visits.
What do you make of her comment accusing Ethiopia for using some inflammatory languages and all that? Were people expecting her to confront Ethiopian government head on?
I think we know that Power is not one to mince words, and I'm sure that when she spoke to officials privately, she was using tough language. Certainly true that there's been inflammatory speech by all the parties to the conflict, and it's definitely important to recognize that this needs to be reined in and toned down. So I hope that her remarks were in the spirit of that as well.
Do you think her expression and, of course, her tough language is indicative that the United States might be looking for another way to firmly get a grip of what is happening and possibly a way out of the situation?
I think the U.S. is frustrated, deeply frustrated with the progress or the lack of progress in resolving this conflict. This is not the first high-level visit by a U.S. official. There have been senators, there have been envoys, there have been other diplomats who've been coming and going. And there have been a number of promises and commitments made by the Ethiopian government that haven't been lived up to. And so it's unsurprising to me that there is now frustration from the side of the U.S. administration.
Could she have done more?
I think the ability of anybody to change the minds of the parties in a very quick flying visit is very limited. But what's clearly needed is an understanding on all of the sides of the conflict, not only the Ethiopian government, but also the Tigrayan side, that there can't be a military solution to this. But it's easier to say that than to achieve it. And unfortunately, Unfortunately, to this point, there hasn't been a clear plan laid out for how to resolve the dispute other than through military confrontation.
Is there a strategy to have visiting Sudan before going to Ethiopia?
Of course, there's lots of things going on in Sudan as well that need attention and a very tenuous transition there. And there's naturally this issue which does affect both Sudan and Ethiopia in terms of the border dispute. And so there are connections there. And ultimately, the region is increasingly concerned at the situation in Ethiopia. But the Ethiopians themselves are going to be the ones to have to resolve their domestic situation. They're the prime actors in any resolution.
There are reports of dead bodies washing off rivers around the area. What do you make of this? Is this an escalation of the conflict or something else is going on?
There's no reason to doubt those reports. Sudanese officials have very little reason to exaggerate. The likelihood of those bodies being washed up in those rivers suggests that there have been further atrocities committed. It's not likely that these were just normalized deaths. There's clearly been some terrible things that have happened to those people. I don't know if it represents an escalation of the conflict as such, because there have been numerous atrocities already. This is just latest in a long line of sad.
That's Alai Varghi, senior advisor to the African Center, U.S. Institute for Peace in Washington, speaking with VOA's Ginny Duofor. Samantha Power's visit to Sudan and Ethiopia has starkly contrasted the trajectory of the two countries, saying Sudan is on a fragile path to democracy, while Ethiopia is mired in conflict and facing famine. VOA senior diplomatic correspondent Cindy Shane reports.
The humanitarian crisis is growing in Ethiopia, and thousands are fleeing to neighboring Sudan. The U.S. is pushing for humanitarian access to millions in desperate need of food and medical supplies due to the fighting in Ethiopia's northern Tigray and other regions that has been raging since last November. The head of the U.S. Agency for International Development, Samantha Power, traveled to Ethiopia and recalled a visit to Sudan 20 years ago when she never imagined it would become an inspiration. Samantha Powers is the USAID administrator.
But thanks to a youth-driven and largely peaceful revolution, one led primarily by Sudan's women, the country is now experiencing a fragile yet hopeful transition to a civilian-led democracy. In Ethiopia, a long-standing partner of the United States, the case is starkly different. A country that has been home to some of the most impressive development gains and economic growth anywhere on the continent, and a regional anchor of stability and security, now finds itself mired in conflict. The government's brutal campaign against the people of Tigray has put the country's people at risk of a prolonged civil war, and the people of Tigray at grave risk of imminent famine.
United Nations humanitarian chief Martin Griffiths said blanket accusations against humanitarian relief agencies, such as the ones made by an Ethiopian official, are dangerous. Adote Akwai of Amnesty International told VOA he agrees. Adote Akwai is with Amnesty International USA.
The rhetoric attacking the principle of humanitarian assistance really shakes and threatens the whole network of laws and conventions and obligations that were created to really try to prevent the worst from being done to people. But it also creates a dangerous kind of atmosphere that allows attacks against humanitarian operations and humanitarian workers, which is equally dangerous.
Akwe told VOA that other countries need to realize how serious the situation in Ethiopia is.
I think the Biden administration has been fairly clear and unambiguous in its leadership and what it's tried to do and call for in Ethiopia. It's time for the rest of the UN Security Council and other African governments to step up and realize that, this is a country that is now potentially going to fragment, and that's going to have major implications for Sudan, Djibouti, Somaliland, Eritrea.
The United Nations has also voiced its frustration at blockages and delays in getting humanitarian aid into Ethiopia's northern Tigray to deal with what it calls the catastrophic situation there. UNICEF says that more than 100,000 children in Tigray could suffer life-threatening malnutrition in the next 12 months. Cindy Sane, VOA News.
South Sudan's Vice President Riek Machar has been ousted as head of his party and its armed forces. The party's military wing said Machar was moved following a three-day gathering of senior SPLM-AIO leaders in the country's far north. A statement signed by military leadership dated August 3rd said Machar has engaged in years-long policy of divide and rule and favored nepotism over unity or advancing their cause. Machar served as vice president in South Sudan's first post-independence government alongside his old rival, President Salva Kiir. But the pair fell out and Machar was fired 2 years later. Troops loyal to each man turned their guns on each other, and South Sudan descended into 5 years of bloodshed. After a string of failed peace accords and violated ceasefires, a new truce was declared in 2018, ending fighting that left nearly 400,000 South Sudanese dead and triggered one of Africa's biggest refugee crises. Machar entered another unity government as deputy to Kiir in early 2020, but the lingering political divisions have plunged the world's youngest nation into an economic and humanitarian crisis. The party's military chief of staff, First Lieutenant General Simon Gatwek Dual, has been declared interim leader. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi sent his foreign minister Sameh Shoukry to Tunisia with a message to President Kais Saied that President el-Sisi backed Saied's moves that froze parliament and took on executive powers with his full support for what he termed as the historic steps taken by the Tunisian leader. Professor Safwan Masri, Executive Vice President of Columbia University's Global Centers, discussed with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi the Egyptian backing of moves that could lead to the same path that Egypt took following Sisi's coup of 2013.
Egypt is part of that axis has on it Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates. Egypt and the Sisi regime are propped up by these Gulf states. Egypt, in many ways, is as a proxy for Saudi Arabia and UAE and as a model of what can happen when a country is aligned with those Gulf states. Egypt's economy is actually doing relatively well under Sisi. We see development that's on the rise. We see employment also on the rise. We see a lot of infrastructural projects. Egypt is flush with Gulf money, and economically it's doing better than it had done before. But it is a more despotic state than it was under Hosni Mubarak. There is no respect for human rights or any semblance of democratic values. And so even though Tunisians resent their country being compared to Egypt, but I think that that is precisely what we're looking at. In Egypt, in July of 2013, you had the same kind of street reactions, jubilation at the coup that took place. Mind you, the Muslim Brotherhood that was ousted had abused its powers constitutionally and otherwise, and Mohamed Morsi, I think, was a horrible president for Egypt. Thus, one can understand the jubilation on the streets of Cairo and other Egyptian cities. But what ended up happening as a result of the coup is that you have a military authoritarian regime that is bankrolled by Gulf states, and you have a state where the economy shows some signs of recovery, but where there is a regression in terms of democratic rights for ordinary Egyptians. And to go back to what Foreign Minister Sameh Shoukry of Egypt has said, it does not come at all as a surprise. I think that Egypt has a stake in Tunisia moving toward an Arab-Muslim center of gravity and getting the backing of the same regimes that have enabled Egypt's authoritarianism.
In your article in the Wall Street Journal, you said that President Saied followed the typical authoritarian playbook, that's military troops surrounding the parliament building to block legislators from meeting. Draconian measures prohibiting public assembly of more than three people were enacted, and media outlets were shuttered. Is Tunisia heading the same way Egypt did?
I think that Qais Saied is going to be moving Tunisia in the direction of Egypt in the following sense. Authoritarianism backed by the military, although one should note that the military in Egypt is far more hegemonic and far more political and controls more than 50% of the economy. That's a very, very different situation than the one that you have in Tunisia. But nonetheless, you have the backing of the military of Qais Saied. You also have a similarity in that frustration with the current governments and power structure, which in Egypt was much shorter lived than it was in Tunisia. In both countries, also, you have the backing of Gulf states fighting political Islam and crushing democracy. But there are huge differences. I mean, in Tunisia, for example, you have a vibrant civil society, which is coming under quite a lot of pressure since the move on July 25 by Qais Saied. But you have a labor union that is quite active, and we have yet to see what happens in terms of its secret negotiations with the president. It's very interesting that the union has not come out in opposition of the president's move, which leads us to one plausible conclusion, and that they are getting the kind of reassurances in terms of no cuts in public sector employment that will allow the union to come out as a hero, which is something that Saied needs and needs to have them on his side. So again, I think, you know, every country is different. Every country has its own idiosyncrasies and peculiarities. But I am worried that the path that Tunisia would follow under Qais Saied would make the country resemble Egypt more and more. But it's also true that Tunisians are riding on the short-term relief of ridding themselves of governing coalitions that have failed them, and of a strong man who is speaking their language and promising them what they so desperately want. And if they continue to support him, I think it is quite likely that the trajectory that Tunisia will be on is going to be very similar to that of Egypt.
That was Professor Safwan Masri, Executive Vice President of Columbia University's Global Centers, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawy. The World Health Organization says more than 700 healthcare workers and patients were killed, more than 2,000 injured, and hundreds of health facilities destroyed in countries of conflict between 2018 and 2020. Lisa Schlein reports from Geneva.
A three-year analysis was carried out in 17 conflict-ridden countries and territories, including Ethiopia, Yemen, Syria, Mozambique, the occupied Palestinian territories, and Myanmar. New data show that healthcare continues to be under attack. So far this year, the World Health Organization has recorded 588 incidents in 14 countries with emergencies, causing 114 deaths and 278 injuries of healthcare workers and patients. The WHO's Director of Health Emergencies Interventions, Altaf Moussani, says the impact of those healthcare attacks goes well beyond claiming lives. He says the ramifications are significant and alarming, especially considering the ongoing COVID-19 response.
Their impact reverberates on healthcare workers' mental health and willingness to report to work, equally on communities' willingness to seek health care, and also drastically reduces resources for responding to a health crisis, amongst others.
Mousani says the ripple effect of a single incident is huge and has a long-lasting impact on the system at large. When health facilities are destroyed, he says, they need to be rebuilt. When healthcare workers are killed or wounded, he says a vital workforce must be reinforced. Building back those vital systems, he says, requires years of costly investment, years in which people in need are underserved.
During the pandemic, more than ever, healthcare workers must be protected, must be respected. Hospitals and healthcare facilities, including the transportation of ambulances, should not be used for military purposes. Essential conditions for the continued delivery of vital healthcare must be given the necessary space.
Mousami notes any reduction in capacity will interrupt services and deprive vulnerable communities of urgent care. The WHO is calling on all parties in conflicts to ensure safe working spaces for the delivery of healthcare services. It says people caught in emergency situations must be able to safely access care free from violence, threat, or fear. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
South Africa's Cape Town is struggling to cope with more than 38,000 active cases of COVID-19, making it the epicenter of the pandemic in Africa's worst-hit country. Vicky Stark speaks to the provincial head of the nursing union in Cape Town, South Africa.
The provincial chairman of the Democratic Nursing Organization of South Africa, Eleanor Roberts, says medical staff is under immense pressure.
As of now, the situation in our rural areas, it is dire because of the fact that there is so much COVID patients coming in and there is so few staff to look after this patient.
She says there are about 13,000 nurses in the Western Cape, which is way too few.
Our members complain that they cannot take it. It is too much for them. There's not enough staff and there's also not enough beds, with the result that they have to struggle to put the COVID patients away from the other patients.
She believes the vaccination drive that is underway in the country is helping to some extent.
But I think the vaccinations in this case did help. However, in Western Cape, as we know, it is very slowly. Like as at last week, Thursday, we heard only 68% of our nurses were vaccinated. So we still are at a great risk.
The province's premier, Alan Windey, is due to give an update on the situation at a digital news briefing Thursday. Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
At the Summer Olympics, Abel Kipsang of Kenya won gold in the tight men's 1,500 meters final with a time of 3 minutes and 31.65 seconds, with the next three finishers within about half a second. Hugues Fabrice Zango won the bronze medal in the triple jump to give Burkina Faso its first ever Olympic medal. He finished with a jump of 17.47 meters, while Portuguese Pedro Picardo won the gold with a jump of 17.98 meters. And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international.